Harley Dunolly-Lee is a linguist who grew up in central Victoria, in Bendigo, in fact. Harley's passion for language and cultural revival can be traced to their great-great-grandfather, Thomas Dunolly. Now, Thomas Dunolly was an activist. He wrote letters and petitions protesting about the treatment of the Kulin on the Corranderk Mission northeast of Melbourne. Harley's sharing their language expertise as part of the Yirrumboi Festival with a symposium at the State Library of Victoria on the 5th of May, unpicking some of the errors, the mistranslations and misinterpretations in the archive of Victoria's Aboriginal languages.
I'm Harley Dunolly-Lee. I'm the community linguist at VACL, which is an acronym for Victorian Aboriginal Corporations for Languages. And what we do at VACL is that we help train Aboriginal Victorians in how to speak their language, learn their language, and how to revive and reclaim their languages.
Were you always interested? I mean, you went to study linguistics at university. You graduated with a degree in linguistics. Were you always interested in languages?
Yeah, I've always been interested in my heritage's languages, but I did an undergrad in archaeology as well. Because I was interested in cultural heritage, and I used to work in cultural heritage too. And then I did my honours in linguistics because that was my passion thing.
So, but your degree's in archaeology with a major in linguistics?
Both majors.
When you started researching and learning more about your language, what did you find in the historical record that... Talk about the misinterpretations or the mistakes in hearing, listening and interpreting our languages?
Well, one of them is that they would, in one recorder, would write the word and then give it one meaning. And then you'll go to a different recorder and you'll find the same word and it'll have a slightly different meaning. And when you find another recorder and say, most of the recorders, it depends on the recorder's attitudes towards Aboriginal people in the 1800s, whether they'll bias towards them or helping them in their situation or fighting for their rights, or whether they were trying to manage them or convert them into Christianity or partake in assimilation. And it also depends on the level of trust that the old people have with these people, because at the same time, you're messing with a time where the old people had just watched their whole population just dwindle to nothing. And their culture slowly dying, people getting sick, diseases, poverty. And then at the same time, the last time you want to tell these people is your language. So you're not even going to give them that information in the first place. And then secondly, the more evidence in the words and the meanings we get more evidence of meanings with people who spent time with the old people, and they spent time with them for 28 years or 30 years. They didn't believe in the Western ideology of Aboriginal people are primitive and their language is primitive and their culture is primitive. But then these people who recorded language more accurately knew that this wasn't the case. That's sort of like a fraction of it, though.
well, tell me more. I mean, the motivations of the recorder, the person who's making the word lists or, talking to elders and trying to discover the meaning of words, their motivation is key here, is what you're saying.
Yeah, there's different motivations. Like, one recorder would be recording for an audience, an academic white audience back in the 1800s, where they want to know, the mysteries of the exotic or the other. They want to know what are these, natives, or what's their language like? We need to see how primitive they are. And so these people would gather word lists and information as much as they can. They collect it and then they'll put it in the way, structured in a way where they're presenting it in this way. Does that make sense?
Absolutely, it makes sense. I guess it's something we have to think about in looking at the archive and looking at these documents that were produced. It's a simple question, like what were they trying to do? Christianize? Because, a lot of word lists were left by
missionaries. Mm. Yeah, a lot of the words and phrases were in the old Psalms. Some of the Psalms were done by the missionaries themselves. They've just, whatever they can, gather the language they can and try and put the words in and trying to translate the language directly from the Psalms. And that's sort of a bit weird because Aboriginal languages aren't like English. So when the missionaries were trying to, you know, preach these psalms in this language, the old people would have just looked at them and like, what are you trying to talk to us about? We don't fully understand. There's a different way of how the languages, how Aboriginal languages are, and the different ways of putting words into a sentence and the grammar and the and all that, and trying to put it into an English way and give it English meanings wasn't a really good. It's really bad, like in the sense that for language revival, this is what we have to work with. But it's good in the sense that we've got something to work with.
And of those recorders who were whose motivations were, say, altruistic. Who,
what do you mean by that word?
Well, who's, you know, they actually cared and believed in documenting our history and our culture, and that it was relevant and that it was important to make a record of it. People whose motivations were clear in a way. Are there many examples of those, say, in recording Victorian languages?
I mean, in journal articles there is. There's a couple of fellas who got given skin names, like Classificare, like they got taken in by the tribe and to be part of their society, but because they trusted them. But at the same time, when these people were writing their journals or when they were writing academically, they still used the academic language that we will consider racist today. But they had to write in that way because that's the only way that was the way of academia back then, is to talk about these people in this way. Some had really good relationships where they would sit down and have a smoke and a pipe, smoking a pipe with them, and they just sit there and talk, get language off one of them for many days. And they would sit down with old people at the missions and talk to them and all that other stuff. But yeah, that's basically some of it.
So in your symposia for the Yirrumboy Festival at the State Library of Victoria, you're going to be talking about misinterpretation.
Of words, trying to put it together and trying to get a bigger picture with, you know, community knowledge, and where does community knowledge today meet with the knowledge that happened back then, but then using linguistics as a tool to revive that lost memory that could be there in the meanings that gives a bigger picture as a whole. Because what I'm talking about is how is linguistics can be used as a tool, because linguistics is a Western science, and Western science and First Nations people haven't been getting along for a very, very long time, because Western science has always defined what are First Nations people, who are they, and it tries to represent them, and that's not the case. And so I'll just, in the symposia, I'll talk about how and why linguistics is used and only used for this benefit only, because it can only be used to benefit the community. It can't, Western science does, it needs to benefit the community.
In terms of the research, is there a real body of knowledge in terms of the historical record of, say, the Kulin languages? There's a strong archive there?
It's random and sporadic, and there is strongness in it. There's like IATSIS, which is the Institute of Aboriginal Studies and Research, and then you've got the Melbourne Museum, and you've got the library, Melbourne, like the Victorian Library, State Library. They hold stuff, but basically all these things are rabbit warrens. See, like you're looking at 18th century, sort of 19th century handwriting that you've got to sit there for literally stare at it for a bit. And you still got to go, okay, what's he saying?
That's just deciphering the handwriting, isn't it?
Yeah.
Mm. And then there's this other thing that happens in, I guess, what we might call language reconstruction. It's trying to, and I was talking to Aunty Faye Stewart-Muir about this idea of forensic linguistics a forensic approach to linguistics where you take what appears to be a pronunciation and work out what is the origin of the person who recorded it.
Yes.
And why would they pronounce it that way?
Yes, she's right in that. She's very, very right in that. That's, you got to question who recorded it and where's it come from, because pronunciation does affect where you're from, what country you're from, what clan you're from, what language group you're from, because there are many different pronunciations of one word. And the thing is with the different spellings and stuff like that is that it's really difficult to try and find that. It becomes so difficult because sometimes they record it and they don't hear the certain sound. And so what linguists have done in the past and do today is they line all the spellings of the same word together from different recorders, and they choose a select spelling from they like to call it an orthography that Aboriginal languages all across Australia and communities and language workers, Aboriginal language workers and that use today. It's a special alphabet to sound out that one sound, because it's one sound, one spelling. And so they try and reconstruct that whole word with that one sound, one spelling, with all those different spellings. But the thing is, you could have a spelling or a few spellings that show the different, slightly different pronunciation of that word. And that's, it's sort of like dance, dance, or tomato, tomato, or vase, vase. So you'll see sort of those things cropping on a bit. And so you sort of question, where is this other pronunciation coming from? Is this sort of like someone from a different part of this tribe's country? The pronunciation is different because it's sort of like, it's language. It's sort of like, English is, it's dialects. It's like English has so many different dialects in England. Not everyone could understand each other, sort of thing. And that's just a dialect. That's just dialects. You sort of got to question it and sort of figure it out, because what a lot of linguists have done in the past is they'll reconstruct the word but only give it one main pronunciation and ignore other possibilities. And only because they're trying to, it's sort of like a reconstruction method where they're trying to do the correct pronunciation that's sort of standard, if you know what I mean. But when you look at these other spellings and more evidence comes through and that, you start to see that, oh yeah, there's many different pronunciations and people were pronouncing these words differently, more so than what is actually thought so.
I mean, there's a lot of things going on when you're doing this work. I mean, as an Aboriginal language worker, you know, it's a real painstaking journey to embark on to, you know, revive a language. It's a lifetime of work. But you're very young, and tell me about the work that you're doing with your own language. I mean, is that something you go back to a lot? I mean,
I try to. It's just getting people in the room, and it's having the capacity to handle these things, and also getting community to have an agreement. And at the moment, it's just these things take a very, very, very long time. And you have to do a lot of background research and a lot of understanding and a lot of mentoring from a lot of people who work in the field, who are linguists, who are Indigenous linguists and academics, and to sort of get and community members and elders sort of get an idea of what it is that's going on. Because language revival is so precious because of what happened in the past, and that if you need to do it in a way that the community is there with you. And if you go up and do it, and this is the thing with Western science, is that, you know, a linguist or someone could reconstruct this language without having the community involved. And what they've done, they made the decision and they made that decision on that language. And then sometimes it can become sort of like gospel. And then somehow, you know, some Indigenous person might go uni and do linguistics, and then they figure out that some of these things are wrong and they're being misled, and they get angry because they thought that that was their language, and then they don't. And then it creates controversy, or it can create problems, especially with communities now when they start questioning. And these things need to be done with the community in a very safe way, because once they all agree on something, that's it. That's how the language is going to grow, and that's how it's going to go. And because they're the ones that's going to be speaking it, not everyone, not the other, you know what I mean?
Not the linguist, not the scientist.
Yeah, and it's not saying that they're all a bad thing. Like all most linguists are really good, and the feel like it's just sometimes it's just this is how the community feels, and this is just the way it goes. And being someone that has done linguistics, but also knows that community background, come from that, and that it's really difficult because you're sort of in between them and that. So you sort of have to move. You sort of have to move in between it a lot, and it's really difficult sometimes because you sort of like you sort of have to understand everything and all this other stuff, and sort of you have to decolonize it as well. You got to see where why the Western science is so powerful in the way it represents and stuff like that. Yeah.
And that word Wurrung, I think I was with Vicky down on her country, Gunditj Mara country at Koroit, actually. And I said, why do all these languages have Wurrung? She's like, tongue. That was what she said. It was like, Kire Wurrung means blood tongue. And like, I guess Wurrung means just to speak, to tongue. Is that your understanding?
Wurrung. Yeah. Woru, this woru, is lips, mouth, speech, and extends to law, because law comes from the speech, the language. And so Jadurong is yes, speech. People who say yes.
Yes, yeah. Well, that's not uncommon. That's how they defined each other, by who says no this way and who says yes that way.
Yeah.
Because no and yes are so crucial to...
Because they're all different.
Yeah.
Because that's what makes them different from their neighbours. Other than that, they're most likely almost similar. Yeah.
And that's the thing a lot of people don't kind of understand.
They can't understand it. They don't wrap their heads around it. It's just like, I just told you what it means and why, and so just go with it.
The people who say no. It's so obvious. The people who say yes.
Yeah, it's our way of saying yes to... make us different from the ones who say, you know, Dagungurong, which means no, or Wurrugai, which means no as well, or Yorta Yorta, which means no too.
Jar Jar Wurrung linguist Harley Donnelly Lee, who will host a symposium at the State Library of Victoria on the 6th of May. Bookings are essential. Details on our website. And the symposium is co-presented by the Victorian Aboriginal Corporation for Languages and the Yirrumboy Festival as part of its Victorian Aboriginal Language Series.